KBLL Portland.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Trippy Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corey Elia, and as always, my co-host,
Leslie McLam.
And so we have a really awesome episode today. I ended up interacting with this woman the other day on Facebook, and then I started researching it at work. And so go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm MK. I'm a data activist and a researcher. My day job is also a global systems integration architect and engineer, so I gravitate towards complexity and nice. Politics.
That's a lot. That's
yeah, a lot going on. You blew my mind when I was reading some of the stuff you were breaking down online. Specifically, there's a lot going on here in Portland. I know one of the major topics right now that's in the news is like the residential infill project, and that was, I believe, one you were commenting on online. And I just kind of more or less I wanted to get your opinion on it because I myself am not fully informed on the whole process, what it's all about, what they're trying to do.
I don't think a lot of people know exactly what the residential infill project even means when they hear those words.
Yeah, and I think that even though that topic has been around for a while, it is inherently confusing. So even those people that have been paying attention even at this point still, as you sort of say, I'm still not quite sure, because there's part of the narrative that says we're in the midst of a crisis of affordability and this is about affordable housing. And yet there's sort of a rising awareness, at least when you start peeling back some of those layers, that say, oh, well, how is redevelopment and replacing existing housing with market rate new construction, how does that even address the source of our suffering?
I think even then people are confused, market rate, what difference that makes, because the market rate has been changing.
Well, what we do know is that there is no shortage of aggregate supply, meaning all of it together. The problem is, even without the residential infill project, the development that we've been seeing is in essence building 90% of the supply for only less than 10% of the people that can afford it, even less. And at the same time, we have billions of dollars in acquisitions. So global private giants coming into the Portland metro area with billions of dollars to spend buying up tens of thousands of existing unprotected, unsubsidized apartment buildings. And we all know what happens when an apartment building goes up for sale. The first thing that happens is rent increases and displacement. So part of the confusion about residential infill is that the premise of it says we need to build more housing and that the majority of the city is zoned low density. And so if we want to unpack some of that, I mean, I could talk for days about that. But I think specifically because people are only now becoming a lot more interested in it because city council is getting ready to vote on it. So it really is important to be able to unpack it in a way that cuts through a lot of the complexity. Land use, zoning, floor to area ratios, all of that stuff is complex.
Right. A lot of people mostly would know about zoning when it comes to like voter lines and stuff like that, gerrymandering, you know, districts.
Right.
Redlining.
And in this case, it's more like rezoning a certain area from single family homes to being zoned for an area that's allowed to have multifamily housing in order to increase
the
density.
So that's a good place to start, because even the way that that narrative is framed, single family homes, leads us to believe, and part of the optics that we've been seeing is only a single map. And this may, for those of you who've even seen some of the headlines, you'll see a single map that's sort of a bird's eye view of Portland. And in yellow, it'll say all of this is single family zoned. And the rhetoric, the false narrative, would also lead you to believe that only single-family homes can be built in 96% of the city. And also further, for people that aren't that familiar with the lay of the land, that the majority of housing types that currently exist in those zones are single-family. And that is inherently false, not only by virtue of what can and can't be built in low-density zones, but what the truth is on the ground. Yeah. It's a technique. It's a logical fallacy. There's two logical fallacies at play here. One is called reification. So Marx talks a lot about reification from the standpoint of this sort of manipulation to distract and to manipulate so that people mistake the abstraction for the reality. So another way of phrasing that is mistaking the map for the territory. And the other logical fallacy at play here, which is, I think, aptly named, considering that the residential infill project narrative says we need middle housing. And middle housing is the difference between a single-family home and a duplex and triplex and quadplex. And so the other logical fallacy that's being reinforced when you just see this bifurcated map that just says everything in yellow, bad. Mm-hmm. Everything in yellow, nothing but this extreme.
Everywhere.
Leads them to think that there is nothing but single family homes. And also the rhetoric would also lead us to believe that everybody that lives in those zones, that lives in the supposedly all in single family homes, are all entitled wealthy white people. And the demographics of the people that actually live in this city, almost 50% are renters. The median family incomes, this is a working class, low income city. There are some pockets. But so the other logical fallacy at play here is called the fallacy of the excluded middle, which I think is very appropriately named, as is the acronym for the Residential Infill Project, RIP Portland, R-I-P Portland. And so the fallacy of the excluded middle is this technique that would lead you to believe that there is only black and white. There is nothing in the middle. There is only single family homes in this single family zone. Just calling it single family zoning is a misnomer. So one of the things that I did to peel this apart, because it just, as somebody, not only I do a lot of mapping around demographics, I do a lot of mapping around housing. I did a 3-month study about 2 years ago to delve into that there was an existing exemption for RELO that would exempt landlords who only had one unit in their portfolio, which would essentially create two classes of renters, those who were protected by RELO and those who weren't by virtue of the size of their landlord's real estate portfolio. And the city could not quantify for us how many renters would be impacted. They refused to do the study. So I had to go in and scrape the entire Multnomah County tax lot database and run some inferences based on the property owner's address and the site address and the type of housing. And we found that approximately like 24,000 households were affected, which is at least 50,000 renters. So data is really important. And there is motivation for these sorts of, this is not a housing proposition. This is a real estate proposition.
That impact study really that you mentioned, is there a place that someone can go and find that online and locate that and read up about that?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There were links to it in a couple of Mercury articles about it, OPP articles. If you want, I can give you a link to make it easier so that you can either put it on the podcast.
And just think about it. So listeners can definitely get more in depth on this topic.
Yeah. And this, again, this is the work that I do, where I sit back and I sort of wait and I say, this is not true. I spend so much time in that bird's eye view with this expensive, difficult software to be able to overlay, to be able to cross-reference. And so one of the things that I did relative to the residential infill project is I said, you know, I've done enough mapping of what multifamily housing exists on the ground. And I've lived in this city for almost 20 years. And I understand that as we travel around, there are already neighborhoods that are densely packed, not only with renters, but with diverse housing types. The very thing that this narrative says we don't have any of and we need more of. And we need more density, when in fact there are densely packed neighborhoods. And even in those neighborhoods that are less dense, like let's say Lentz, when I mapped what are presumed to be rental properties, so non-owner occupied single family homes, this is the low hanging fruit of speculative redevelopment. This is what RIP is targeting. And it's saying, if you've got a single family home on a lot, that's not the best use of that lot. And we need density. And any renter living in a single family home, particularly if they've been there for a while, as soon as these sort of land use upzones go into effect, it doesn't even matter what gets built there. It doesn't matter if anything gets built, because the way that real estate operates, the way that land values operate, and it's called an exchange value, is that when you upzone, the exchange value, what can be developed on that lot citywide, automatically it makes the dirt more expensive. And so all of those portfolios that a large holder of land is holding on to right now, we have, and Wall Street is in the landlord business, by the way, and in the single family home business.
Oh, yeah.
So when you've got a large portfolio of single family homes in a residential neighborhood, and then something like RIP passes, all of the sudden, the speculative value of that portfolio is going to triple, regardless of what gets built. So it exacerbates a crisis of affordability. And you know, racial capital has been the villain all along and is not going to be the savior all of the sudden if we deregulate and let them continue to buy at a bargain and redevelop at a premium while at the same time displacing the most vulnerable renters who are barely housed.
Yeah. It sounds like you're saying, like, as soon as these types of changes pass, you know, the value of that dirt, of that house that goes up, they could be charging a lot more for each of those units, therefore increasing the portfolio value for the developers. And,
right.
And the more people they can pack into that tiny one house, or what was a single family home, one house lot, the more they can extract out of value out of it.
Well,
so it's actually, this is playing into the developers' hands, is what it sounds like you're saying.
Absolutely, absolutely. Part of speculation, part of what we learned in the first housing bubble and crash, was that in 1999, finance deregulation, so the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which allowed the casino market and the commercial lending to hedge their bets and to play both sides of the market, to bet against the economy and to bet for it. And the long shot bets paid off exponentially. So when the economy was crashing, those who had enough capital were cashing in. And
buying up everything that other people were trying to very quickly offload to survive.
Right, right. And so this idea of speculation and this idea of density, it's also important to note that it's more expensive for a developer to build a quadplex. So the more kitchens you have, the more expensive it is. And mm-hmm. we've already seen, if you drive around, you've seen what new development duplexes look like and how much they cost, right?
I have been seeing all sorts of buildings and new living situations that are arising up there, marketing themselves as a different type of lifestyle, where they're saying, oh, here's a community kitchen for these four apartments, that you all have your own personal bedroom, but there's a shared bathroom and a shared kitchen,
okay.
but you have your private entrance. And these weird new constructions, these odd buildings that don't have parking, that don't have a lot of access. Unless, like, they're gated, they're very...
So now you're getting into something that, again, there's a lot to unpack.
Sorry, my brain just started going so fast.
This is actually more important. And it leads into that idea of speculation. Because what we have now is iBuyers and iRenters. What we have now is a whole new emergent technology
that is
based on, well, it's not even just digital, it is treachery. So we have Zillow, for instance, is going into the iBuyer. We have these platforms that are being fueled with billions of dollars of venture capital to be able to purchase in bulk with cash using algorithms.
Right. So they're ahead of the human game and they're predictive on what is going to be the next cheapest property or area to put the money into,
so they can gain the most
out of it.
And they can do it at a bargain and they can do it in bulk. But it's not even just about that, because Wall Street is in the landlord business. And that's something that we really need to understand, is that renters are already in a captive market. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen a larger and larger market share even here of these large institutional buyers grabbing up property. And part of inflating that speculative bubble that allows them to conjure trillions and trillions of dollars from a pool of, say, $50 million in investment, they can conjure billions just by virtue of the fact that it is divorced from its social utility. And when you financialize, meaning when you bundle together all of that new debt created by these artifacts of development, bundle it together, create a bond, and trade it on the stock market like stocks, then it doesn't even matter if you're building homes for people to live in. What matters is, and we learned this the first time around, and that was a very simplified model. And this is now a recalibrated model where private equity has trillions of dollars in what's called dry powder, which is liquid cash to go on a shopping spree. And they have created these tech platforms that allow them to buy in bulk with no hassle to all of these other investors who are sitting on rental properties. And then they can do a couple of things. They can turn those into Airbnbs. They can bundle those properties and they can turn them into rentals. Wall Street, you know, Blackstone was the first to go into the rental business because they were also the first to create rent-back mortgage securities. So we are in, the fact that we're not in high alert like they are in some other countries. The UN Special Reporter for Housing, Leilani Farah, has been writing extensively about this. There is a documentary called Push that we really want to get here that is going around the world saying this is not just happening in your city. This is not just happening in the West Coast. This is happening everywhere because global private equity operates everywhere. And real estate has always been this place where it's great for money laundering. It's in times of economic turmoil and different sort of trade negotiations. It's somewhat recession-proof if you can hold on to it. And then when you add in all of these other speculative mechanisms on top of it, the fact that, you know, members of city council, all of them, if they don't understand what I'm talking about right now, they should not be voting on any of this. They should mm-hmm. be going back to school. If they can't have this conversation, can't agree that this is happening, and if we're not all on the same page, then we can't understand the risk. And so the narrative of things like the residential infill project would lead us to believe, number one, that there's no capacity, that we've run out of room, when in fact, there is testimony from Joe Zender, who at the time was, I think, the interim director for the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. He testified in Salem against a different bill and said there, we've got more capacity within the urban growth boundary than we need. Capacity is not the problem. You know, we've got the capacity to build 1.3 million more homes than our projected 20-year growth rate. He said the problem is the market and infrastructure. So we've got these dueling narratives from real estate lobbyists who want more than anything to unlock new opportunity to create new financialized debt, to create new captive markets for renters, and to displace the demographics that they don't want in this global city inner core right. utopia.
A displacement of gentrification, and that is something that Portland has heard multiple times. And that was something that our guest Laquita Lanford had spoken about when it comes to a few of the like Mississippi and the Alberta Arts Districts, North Portland, Emmanuel Hospital.
Albina.
Right. And these are areas that are very quickly being gentrified. And that is where the evidence of big developer money is coming in. And they are building these giant buildings. They're very tall. They're anywhere from 4 to 6 stories. They're changing the skyline. And mm-hmm. they're all owned by some similar properties. You're seeing a lot of the same names over and over again, as well as for in the houses that are for sale or the apartment buildings. I'm seeing
and those names
like Windermere, Living Room Realty. Right.
Those names keep changing because what happens right. is that even one of the things that happened out of the first housing crisis is that the building industry consolidated. And so now we even have private equity working with consolidated builders to build these speculative artifacts. And I shouldn't even say build, to mass produce. And I think we need a new name. Gentrification is something that there are different interpretations of gentrification.
It usually has cultural implications.
Yeah, and there's a lot of white people mostly sitting around arguing about whether gentrification can be good or not. Mm-hmm. But gentrification as a, and I'm not going to call it a natural phenomenon, but I'm going to call it something that is more human-driven in the past versus global speculative redevelopment of scale. So this is not gentrification.
Is what you're saying.
Well, gentrification sometimes is that you have economic conditions that where people with more money come into a neighborhood and they buy up cheap real estate and the demographics change. And also there are still some things that are attendant with that kind of gentrification, like then all of a sudden those areas start getting policed differently because there's more white people there. But that is not, I think it was Sasia Soskin who in this documentary that I'm talking about, there's a quote from her that, you know, it takes a minute to digest, but she said, this is not gentrification, and something to the effect of saying, you know, like, this is on such a scale that it makes gentrification look like something that is, you know, if only, if so only it were gentrification.
Essentially, you're basically getting at that, like, gentrification would only be happening in certain neighborhoods, but this is happening all across the city.
You're saying this is, like, mass global. This is technology, algorithm, data, and money driven.
This is driven by global private equity. And if you look around, and it's easy for us to be myopic when we're trying to survive. And it's easy for us to be myopic also when we're trying to survive and we're trying to not only personally survive, but trying to keep people literally from dying as a result of what is happening. But when we look and we say, well, gosh, I'm seeing the same patterns in L.A., San Francisco, in different parts of Europe and in Germany, in all around the globe. And this is why it's very important. I would encourage people to search for Leilani Farah and some of the writings that she has been writing.
How do you spell her name?
Leilani Farha. And she is the UN Special Reporter for Housing. So she is tasked with going around the globe and assessing, you know, the UN at least has recognized that housing is a human right.
They have.
and she has been putting together these patterns and then also tracing it back to global private equity and doing some really difficult research and then writing these reports that say global private equity giants such as Blackstone are not only responsible for creating this crisis of affordability, but profiting from it and exacerbating it and perpetuating it. And then we also have authors like Naomi Klein who impress upon us the reality of disaster capitalism from this global sort of higher, not just about housing, but I think it's something intuitively that we understand that not only is it really expensive to be poor, but that there are all of these mechanisms, that these constructs that not only keep people poor, but extract this wealth. And real estate in particular has always been the method by which racial capital creates these constructs and creates these different types of, I call it, it's not just my phrase, but tabula rasa planning, which is, you know, we've seen the impact of urban renewal. Let's just bulldoze, you know, this. And these cycles of gentrification, which are a withholding of resources to devalue the land and then a revalorization of that prime property. And then you've got projects that come in, whether it's, you know, to build a freeway or a hospital. RIP is no different, except that when you had smaller scale things like redlining. Redlining was that you could live here, but you could not live here. Now there is no place to go. And this isn't just me talking. As far as RIP goes, so there's the Planning and Sustainability Commission. This was a advisory group that made a final recommendation to go to City Council. And their final vote was 5-4, 5 in favor of RIP, 4 against. All three of the members of color of that commission voted against it, specifically because of the displacement impact. One of the commissioners, named Andre Bao, repeatedly over and over again said this is institutionalized racism. Institutionalized racism is when we normalize this type of displacement, which specifically and more rapidly focuses more intense displacement impact on communities of color and low-income renters and immigrant communities. And that is exactly what this does. And yet, they were outvoted by a majority white male commission. And none of that narrative made it outside of those chambers. The headlines coming from and the repeated narrative coming from these lobbyist groups was that the only people that were opposed to residential infill were white, NIMBY, entitled homeowners. And yet...
It sounds like you're describing the people that voted yes fit that well-to-do people that have
the
property.
The conflicts of interest.
Right.
One of them, one of the vice chair of that committee is Eli Spivak. He is a developer of middle housing.
So essentially, they just used the political rhetoric that they felt would be accepted about how they voted about it to try and drive their narrative home.
And this is not just happening here. This is the era that we live in. Yes.
Yes, this is political corruption, and this is exactly why journalism exists.
It's propaganda.
Well, I'm also seeing that, like, this kind of development and the changing of all the land use and all that, the rezoning, so you're getting people that have more money in or trying to get people with the right metrics in your area to extract wealth from. This is a thing that's leading to the houseless crisis that I know my co-host follows a lot on that topic.
This was one that I was actually just getting into an argument with a few people on Reddit, and actually a real estate agent over in St. John's that I just found out might have done like an assessment of a property of $30,000 less than it was just because of the new move from Hazelnut Grove over to there. And she's trying to help out the St. John's Neighborhood Association to try and push back against it. Saying,
interesting. They're worried about their property values being lowered because of transitional camp.
And then one of the other ones that I was looking at was, there was somebody that was trying to sit there and say that the 16,000 prospective units that are vacant locally is a myth.
Right.
I would like to know, I also read that, where did that 16,000 vacant units number come from? Who conducted that study? When was it done? 2017, 18?
So that is just the tip of the iceberg, because that number comes from the U.S. Census American Community Survey. So the American Community Survey is an estimate. It is not anything that even has a level of granularity. So that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, that's why I said potential.
That's potential. And what that does is it classifies vacancies based upon the sort of baseline of the census. And then it classifies them into vacant for sale, vacant bank-owned, part-time, in some of those categories. When you actually look at some of the things that I look at, which are when you look at building permits and when you look at, population, and you see how many units are being built versus what the population is, what needed housing is.
Well, there's not as many units being built as to equate with how fast the population
is
changing.
Well, the other thing is that part of this narrative would lead us all to believe that we were completely caught unaware, that all of a sudden all of these people moved here and there wasn't any place for anybody to live. In order to accept that, and that is an organic, natural thing, that it's just based on supply, you would also have to accept that that happened every single place in the world where that is experiencing the same economic violence all at once, that all of a sudden there wasn't just a population migration boom, but a population explosion where all of a sudden fully formed renters and home buyers descended from above onto all of these places all around the world at once. The other thing is like we were talking about zoning, 10 years ago, people didn't even know what zoning was. But now that it's close to home, that's become part of our sort of collective conversation. And when we're talking about population numbers and they throw out and they say, you know, X thousand people moved here, people that don't understand the trends of population go, oh my gosh, they see this as a stampede of people, of zombies all at once stampeding, saying we all want houses, brains. Whereas when you actually look at things like population growth rates, and you see that the growth rates over time, how things fluctuate, and how that when you have a population growth rate peak, how long does that peak for? Right now, population in Portland, it's going down.
People are leaving Portland because they cannot afford to live here anymore.
The other thing that happens with that narrative is, and pay attention to this, is sometimes they will just frame it as how many people moved here. They won't talk about net migration.
Yes.
And so there's a bunch of ways to lie about the statistics. But if we want to actually find out how many vacancies there are, and because I look at not only building permits that have been submitted, but building permits that have been finaled, meaning that they've actually been built and delivered. So to keep up with Portland's growth rates, we need about between 3,500 and 4,500 new units a year. We've been churning along. And to give you some idea, I believe it was in 2017, they delivered 10,000 new units. And then what they did to not have to be held accountable to inclusionary housing, which would set aside a token amount of units at, 80% median family income, which is still almost $80,000.
Yeah.
But I digress. They shoved almost 4.5 years of permits into the final quarter of 2016, I believe it was, so that they could continue to build without having to be beholden to inclusionary housing. 19,000 units in the chamber, the same year that they delivered 10,000 units fully formed, when to keep up with growth rates, we need about 3,500 to 4,500.
So it sounds like an influx of new units at that time.
So and 2017 was the peak, but we're in a state of hyper surplus, so much so that when you go behind the paywalls of industry reports, not just the stuff that you see in the headlines, but the stuff that you have to pay for access to, where the industry talks to itself and says, do we buy, do we sell? Right now, in 2020, you've got local developers saying, boy, this was such a banner year. 2010 to 2020 was unprecedented, and we're still gorging ourselves. Jordan Schnitzer himself, in one of these 2020 recaps, made some statement to the effect that it was like it had just been Thanksgiving for 20 years, and they just couldn't stop eating. And at the same time, outside on the ground, people are having debates saying, there are no vacancies. Well, of course, that's the narrative. And yet they're talking out of their ass, because the only way that we're going to settle this debate is to get the data. And the only way to get the data is through meter level utility data that says that, and they have this data. PGE has this data. The city could get it if they wanted to. The only thing we have until then are inferences that have to do with building permits. But what we do know is that 16,000 is just based on the census
data.
Yeah, our estimates based on population, and there's a metric that is acceptable, which is about 2.37 people per household, per unit, average throughout the city. So when you add all of that up, we're looking at, just in Portland, we're looking at like 35,000. And what they do in those vacancy statistics too is, you'll hear them if you debate it, they'll talk about lease up periods, and they'll say, well, absorption. And so part of what they do when they shave off vacancy rates, if you even look at it on a graph, you'll see that the vacancy rates for what they call 4- and 5-star properties, these that are priced at above market, or for, to put it another way, priced at about 120%
of the
average rental price, the vacancy rates for that level of housing, which they are churning out, the predominantly almost 85% of new units are at that level. The vacancy rates for those are in the double digits, whereas the vacancy rates for housing that people can actually afford are going down. And that's not only because of double-digit rent increases and people getting priced out and moving out, but that's also because of what I mentioned earlier, where you have acquisitions of tens of thousands of existing units that then get converted to market rate because they price all of those people out. And it doesn't take long in this city, if you hand out, even in Portland where you've got some caps, all it takes is one 9.9% rent increase to price somebody out completely.
There are people that can't afford $100 a month increase, and that's it. They have to move out of Portland.
Exactly.
They're on a limited or finite income, Social Security, disability, all sorts of things.
See, sorry about interrupting this whole stream of consciousness, but you did bring up a name that I really want to touch base on is Schnitzer. And yep. his whole involvement with Wapato, and apparently in less than 3 weeks, Wapato has raised over $2.5 million. And I really want to know how much of that is coming from, like, real estate agents.
Private donations.
And private donations from, like, developers.
You don't
and
get to know.
I won't
you don't
know.
Get to know.
But I'm betting a lot of that money came from those kind of folks.
Of course, it comes from business associations. It comes from all of those landowners that want. And one of the things you mentioned too that is connected here, where you're talking about property values and some of the popular narrative, and this is true. Some, you know, there are contingents. We know this of, you know, housed individuals who, you know, just don't like. Poor people don't like mm-hmm. houseless people, and they're worried about their property values. But the larger consolidation of power, it's not so much that they're worried about property values going down. What they're worried about, not even worried about, what is not acceptable to the real estate industrial complex is that valuable land we should be extracting the maximum value out of that land. And so the idea of housing as a human right, of housing people in the communities in which they live and work and socialize is contrary to the extraction of wealth, that especially when you've revalorized the entire city core. And
they're
so,
capitalizing on this industry. It's affecting real people's lives. It's literally changing the entire face of the city, as well as the ways that people interact in this city.
There's absolutely.
Something that you said that I feel like listeners might want a little more understanding based on when you were talking about there's so much more in the market as far as available units, but somehow that they are more expensive, especially since we've heard whenever there's more product in an industry, when it's oversaturated, that tends to, based on high school economics, they told us if there's an oversaturation in the market, that's going to reduce the prices.
Right.
So theoretically, that's what I've heard in some narratives, is that if we build more units, that the amount of units will naturally reduce the cost of those units just by having more. And I just wanted to clarify that you were kind of touching on that their intentional manipulation by the developers are making sure that natural market feature doesn't occur, that can't extract as much as possible.
But that is actually, that's not how supply and demand works in the
reality.
Rental market. Yeah, because that idea of filtering or trickling down or that idea of this oversimplified teeter-totter idea of supply and demand, that is predicated on something that isn't true, which would make the rental market a single unified rental market where everybody had access to the same information all the time. And there was this fluidity when, in fact, the real estate and particularly the rental market is hierarchical. It is segmented. And so 4- and 5-star luxury apartments don't become Class B, Class C level investments, regardless of how much supply there is. And the other thing that that we learned is that when you top load the market like that, what it does is it drives prices up. Mm. And particularly, it drives up what's called the ground rent. So it makes the value of the dirt more expensive, and real estate operates by proximity. And so if you have a tenement next to a brand new, very expensive apartment where, you know, a studio is $2,000, then existing rents are going to go up around that. The other thing that we learned by virtue of studying how the first cataclysmic bubble and burst operated in terms of the securitization of mortgage-backed securities, and now we have rent-backed securities, is that it doesn't even matter if they create a hyper surplus of empty luxury units, because as long as all of the speculators at that level are still trading, meaning they're still placing their bets at the table and they're still winning, and they keep winning as long as they keep betting. So flipper flips to another flipper, flips to another flipper. And as long as they're jacking the prices up, they want prices to go up. They want things to be more expensive. That's how they get their dividends. And that's how they keep recycling old debt into new debt into new debt. And that's where the value, that's what the demand is. The demand is not for housing for people to live in at that level. The demand is for more debt, financialized debt. And it actually works in their favor if it's empty. They can write the losses off. They can also just keep trading it. But what happens is that at the top of that market, where the prices are way overvalued, and then the market is so oversaturated that that fool that got into that speculative market late, and there's not another greater fool in line for them to flip that to, then all of the sudden, you've got all these people, I shouldn't say people, all of these LLCs holding on to property that all of the sudden they can't flip. And then what do? They walk away from their mortgages en masse because those mortgages aren't taken out by human beings who have any skin in the game. They're taken out by corporate entities that can walk away from their loans. And that's what happened the last time. And what it does is it benefits the part of the casino that insures those bonds. This is what we learned. We know this to be true. This isn't guessing. And that's how Wall Street giants like Blackstone cleaned up the first time, when you artificially jack prices up, and then when you know that what happens is that all of a sudden things are going to be devalued, then the people, the large giants that have all the cash, they get to capture even greater market share and get to capture even greater swaths of this captive hostage rental market. So it's complex. It's a lot to unpack. But I think the takeaway here is that we're not just talking about our grandfather's housing market. We're not even talking about our parents' housing market. We need to wake up. We don't need to understand all of it and all of its complexity to just wake up and say, this is a whole new ball game that is the difference between a teeter-totter and a casino. And the house always wins. Mm-hmm. And you may feel like it's, you know, this roller coaster up and down, you're winning, you're losing, and you may feel like somehow it's just the roll of the dice and it's some natural phenomenon, but it's not. As soon as you walk in that door, and we can't get out of this casino. We walked in the door as soon as we deregulated, as soon as we repealed Glass-Steagall, and the only way we're getting out of that casino is by rooting this corruption out at the root.
And I think that regulation is something that some people have thought about in some ways, because we've seen more local or state jurisdictions try to tackle in what they see might help by saying we're going to have restrictions or caps on how much you can charge renters in this area, stuff like that, to try and limit how quickly these rates are going up. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a lot of that pass. I know Salem talked about that a couple of times.
It's still not too, I mean, the thing that passed in Salem with Senate Bill 608 still allows, what it does is it normalizes a rent growth rate that's about 10%. And, you know, 3% is enough to put somebody on the street. 2% is enough to put somebody on the street. These incremental changes, and there's studies that have also found that there's a sort of a threshold that, you know, we talk about this, like if you're spending more than 30% of your income on housing, there's a threshold at about 32-33% of your income where incremental rent increases actually exponentially increase the rate of houselessness, that it's mm-hmm. not a one-to-one correlation, that it's a snowballing effect. And so even small rent increases like 3%, 5%, if you're already, and most people are already spending more than 50% of their incomes, so if you get a 2% increase and you're already over that 32% threshold and you don't have a safety net, so there is a snowballing effect, you know, and nationwide, this is the other wake up that we know to be true, we know it to be true, is that nobody anywhere can afford housing.
Yeah,
I've seen that there. I think it was like New York Times or one of the major AP news or articles that was talking about how in the majority of the U.S., the average person, say, working at the minimum wage has to work something like 80, 150 hours.
Yeah.
I think it was something around 80 hours or so for Portland in order to afford a basic median market rate apartments and like, in this city, you would have to work at least 3 full-time jobs that are 40 hours a week, that sort of thing. It was crazy to me.
And the fact that things like the residential infill project and all of these things are being marketed as some sort of antidote to this. So they've got this new amendment that says, well, how about this? So, the numbers didn't – we get that the argument that market rate's not really going to help. So how about if we raise the bar even further and you can build 6 to 8 units on a lot as long as some of those units are deeply affordable? But what that that is a distraction over here, because they've also admitted that the nonprofits that would be able to avail themselves of that are the minority of the type of development that would take advantage of upzoning 96% of the city in a city that doesn't restrict demolitions whatsoever. Demolition by right. So this idea that this is somehow an antidote to this spectrum of housing. So we're not just talking about middle-income folks or people that are currently housed. We're talking about a land grab that doesn't restrict demolitions, that will increase the speculative value of the dirt citywide, and it will hurt people. It will kill people. And somehow we're debating whether or not we've got 16,000 vacant units or whether it's 30,000. Somehow we're debating, you know, whether or not people have the right to remain.
Or the right to purchase land. So if they've been removed, I know that was something in some of the historic districts like Mississippi or with Emmanuel Hospital Project, that some of the community that had been displaced eventually had the opportunity to, if they had the means and, you know, could afford time to go back and find documentation to prove that their family had been displaced during that project, they sort of would get first rights and get some city assistance into other areas, and so that they wouldn't be displaced out of the city.
And that actually never happened.
Well, and that idea, too, even part of this sort of amendment package that says, well, how about if we add in, like, a right to return? And yet, like, what that says...
Who can afford the right to return? Some people literally cannot take the time to go and seek those documents, to find the records, to go through and file the forms needed, get a lawyer.
Being displaced, as if being uprooted, as if saying, okay, your landlord just sold your home and there's no place for you to go, but come back in a year and you'll get preference on this waiting list. If the displacement doesn't kill you, then suffer well in the meantime,
and then you can
come back. And that is the fact that that's even something that
is normalized.
That is normalized, that people are debating, saying, well, that amendment sounds good. Those giveaways reward the violence that happens in the present at some future promise that maybe someday those who've suffered well can get some reparation, some sliver of a reparation that may or may not actually come to fruition after the damage is done. And that's how we continue to operate, based on trust that somehow the same forces that have displaced, exploited, extracted, and killed are somehow going to, we can inject some sense of goodwill.
There's
into
an assumption
that
something may also change with what you're saying, that someone gets ousted now because their property was sold out from under them where they're living and renting. So we'll put you on that waiting list if you come back in a year. What are the changes that are occur in that year? We're going to assume that things are going to be the same or better, that someone's going to be able to afford to come back a year later if they can't afford it now, if they can't afford relocating in the city to another property, they couldn't afford to stay there and deal with the rising rent. And as we're talking about what the Salem bill that allows up to a certain amount of increase, if you're renting an apartment for $1,000, that $50 increase could kill you. And if you can manage that once or twice, then that happens every 6 months. Where are you in 2 years? You're at $1,200 for your apartment. And where is the rising rate of employment wages to go with that? I think the hugest thing, and people are noticing that we are not getting the means to support ourselves and our livelihoods at all. We're lucky if we can afford the rising transportation and food costs, and now we have to worry about rising housing costs.
I would also add that same Senate Bill 608 that normalized 10% rent increases, 7% plus inflation, It exempts all new construction for 15 years, and not 15 years from today forward. 15 years
from the date,
date of the that it got its occupancy. So that is also retroactive. So anything that was built 15 years ago, exempt. Anything that gets built now, exempt for 15 years. And that slides along. That's not pinned to this place in time. So there's a 15-year bubble, forwards and backwards, that moves forward in time of being exempt. So that's also why redevelopment and this false narrative that says we're in the midst of a crisis of affordability and we have to build more new housing at the same time, it's exempt.
Clearly, there's a lot for us to talk about. We've been having an amazing conversation.
We could have a whole show about the GE Current stuff.
Yeah. I was just thinking, the conversations that we had beforehand and how public spaces are being changed with capitalizing on public spaces by surveilling people and who can use them, why you can use them.
I can send you a couple of links, like food for thought, about how that intersects with some of the stuff that you already know and have an awareness of. And that might be a lot more fertile ground to really dig into. I think surveillance, you know, there's ways that we could talk about it in this. But
there's a lot more there.
And then also how displacement isn't just about people being on the streets, but now we want to displace the displaced. Like, it's not good enough, and yet I don't know that surveillance is something that, whatever you want to do.
Well, there's surveillance capitalism is its own thing. And it's like you're saying, it's all about controlling public spaces and creating valuation in certain areas.
Yeah.
It all has to do with exactly what we're talking, property development and Wall Street. And so I do think that is probably something that could be a larger episode.
We'd love to have you back on.
I would love to talk about that, because there's also tie-ins there with transit-oriented development, not only with housing and surveillance and public space, but also some stuff that people might not be aware of that can fit into that, like the fact that the entire Central East Side Industrial District has been renamed the Innovation Quadrant, that there's all this stuff that people aren't aware that's already here, and that Portland is now officially and has been a living test lab for things that are very treacherous. But the current IQ, I think, is a central stuff that maybe I can send you some stuff that can inform that, and we can build some stuff that really, really wakes people up to stuff that's already here and what it's already been used for elsewhere, rather than the specter of kind of nebulous.
This is a huge topic, and I feel like this is going to have to be a whole nother episode. It's been great talking with you, MK. I want to invite you again back soon so we can talk about the whole current IQ and all that. Like always, ladies and gentlemen, this is Corey Elia with Trippy, Politics, Protests, and
Potpourri. I'm Leslie McLam, and thank you very much for sitting down and talking with us. Like I said, there's so much information. We could probably go for another hour, and we're going to have to cut it off. I do want to ask if there is any information you'd like to put out for the listeners to find you, contact you. Do you have a social media page or an email address if anybody has questions on the research that you've done on this topic?
You can find me online under Nerdletta.
Nerdletta. Awesome.
Okay.
Nerdletta.
Yes.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Have a good day, ladies and gentlemen.
KBOO Portland.